Welcome. I'm going to call this meeting to order of the Senate Interim Committee on General Government and Accountability for, what is today, November 6th?
Mr. Chair, it's November 13th.
November whatever it is, 13th. Thank you. So Cheyenne, if you want to tell us what we're going to do first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the agenda order at the moment is first an update from Mr. Salus, the statewide interoperability coordinator, and then an update on 2018 committee bills, but you could consider switching those depending on how many people are waiting. Those are the only two agenda items.
Okay, well, I think we can, how long is your presentation? So why don't we do the others first? Why don't we switch these and do the committee bills first? So I'll open a information hearing on the committee bills.
Mr. Chair, Senate committees each have three bills, and the concepts that you are considering are a redraft of Senate Bill 10 from 2017. That's the transit bill. It may not be an identical redraft, but it basically calls for appointment rather than election of Mass Transit District Board members and repeals some sections of Chapter 267. Again, that's a redraft of Senate Bill 10 from 2017. The next would be a periodic review process for boards and commissions, a deeper dive into boards and commissions, perhaps something modeled after the tax credit review process where they come up and are reviewed on a regular basis. And the third would be a redraft of Senate Bill 1038 from 2017. This is the including a 60% score on naturalization test among the requirements to receive a high school diploma. It was previously drafted, I believe, by former Senator Starr.
Mm-hmm.
And those would be the three bills.
So any discussion about those bills and where we're looking at going?
Just a question as to how, I guess, that conclusion was reached for
yeah.
those three.
Well, I can tell you that one of them, the boards and commissions, is a follow-up, so it's something that we've been working on previously, and I want to continue working on.
I didn't say I didn't like some of these. I'm just wondering.
Right. The transit bill, that's a request from the president's office.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's unlimited bills, so let him.
Yeah.
So, and the third bill is at again at the request of former state senator Bruce Starr, and who happens to be here if anybody has any questions about that bill of why and where we're going with that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some concern about the bill we passed last year, this year still,
mm-hmm.
About confidentiality of email addresses that people give us from being under public purview. So I still have some concerns that that there were some mistakes made in the writing of that bill and fixing them.
So I would be, frankly, okay with replacing the boards and commissions for this coming session and moving that to the next full session. If that was something that the committee wanted to do.
Well, I am under the understanding that the Senate President's office gets unlimited bills, right? And if he wants that particular one, then we could come up with, you know, an actual committee bill that is at the request of the committee. Just saying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'll check in with the President's office and see if they want to move that to his bills. They thought it was appropriate to be in this committee.
So, Mr. Chair, can you go over those again? Because I'm looking to see what the list is, since I had not seen a list.
Right.
Was assuming this is coming off the cuff for most of us.
Mr. Right. Chair, Senator Brzozinski, again, it was a redraft of Senate Bill 10 and a redraft of Senate Bill 1038. those would be two of the concepts that are based on previous bills, and the other is still in concept form, no previous bill to reference the boards and commissions.
So the boards and commissions, is that that's not the transit one?
No.
Okay.
No, with the boards and commissions, what we really are looking at is potentially a review process in sort of the way we do the tax credits, so that we, every 6 years, we look at those boards and commissions that exist and maybe don't renew them. Other questions, comments?
Well, what is the timing on this? When, I can't remember the dates of when these particular concepts would have to be submitted, and do we have another legislative days to consider that before?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, the deadline to request concepts is a week away. It's next Tuesday,
okay,
the 21st.
It's coming up, yeah. Right.
So the request will be made, and then the LCs will issue, and probably the chair will distribute them to the members prior to introduction in January for the short session in February.
Yeah, and I will chat with the president's office and see if we can substitute the email bill for his transit bill. And
good,
see.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And can we have some discussion? I wonder if Senator DeVore can just tell us some of the issues that just remind me as to some of the things that you still thought that maybe we didn't draft
well, I
right.
Think we were under a misconception of what the bill actually did.
Okay.
And then we had a request to give up our email list to anybody that would ask for them. And a constituent that signs up on a email list for a newsletter, I think, expects some privacy, that email couldn't be given to absolutely anybody that requests it. And not that, you know, we can... Somebody can certainly subscribe and have their email, but if they want to know the information, just subscribe and we'll be happy to send them the newsletters. But I have this real hesitancy of when somebody says, you know, put me on your list, that they envision that is a protected email list and not subject to anybody that has requested that email list.
Right.
And again, if there's questions about the other bill, the civics bill, Senator Starr and Representative Kitts are here to answer questions if needed.
So. Would that be an education bill?
It is.
Okay, but we
Why
would
are
be
we
submitting
doing
it as a committee bill, but not hearing it necessarily.
Because in my opinion, and the reason we're doing it in this one, first of all, is because my constituent asked for it.
Okay.
and secondly, it is a government civics issue as opposed to just a pure education issue.
Okay. So we can make the case to actually hear the bill in here, you think?
Yes, we can.
Perfect.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just for reference, it's House Bill 2874. That's the email confidentiality bill.
What was it?
House Bill 2874. That we keep referencing.
We could probably ask the House.
So, the other bill that you mentioned was Senate Bill 138.
1038. 1038.
Yes, sir.
Anything else on the bills right now? Okay, so I'm going to close that informational hearing, and we're going to move on to another informational meeting on the interoperability, statewide interoperability. And we have David Solos here to give us a presentation. So don't forget to put in your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Solis. I'm the statewide interoperability coordinator. Our program is within the office of the state CIO, which is in DAS. And that program was moved there by operation of statute in 2014. Previously, it was in ODOT. Interoperability, it's sometimes it sounds simple, but it isn't. To put it in a little perspective, if you and I are on the same cell phone plan, we have operability. You're on phone A, and I'm on phone A, and we just call each other, and we're talking on the same network. Interoperability is more like when a Verizon talks to an AT&T and all that, and everything that goes on behind there. And we think it's magic, and we're pretty used to it, and we have grown used to it. At the public safety realm, it's a little different matter entirely. I was on a federal database last week and looked at the number of public safety entities in Oregon according to that database, and there were about 500 primary first responder agencies in Oregon and about another 300 secondary or support first responder agencies in Oregon. And so they all have varying radio systems and radio assets and networks that they use, and the interoperability is making sure that all of these first responders can talk to one another, and even first responders from other states when we have issues on the border, or people come across the state to help us, or we send people across the borders to go help them. So that's what we're after in this quest for what we call interoperability. In addition to that, about a year and a half, 2 years ago now, I guess it was, there was a little bit of money left over in the state radio project budget that was pulled and reserved for some interoperability work, and we did a grant program with some of that money. And with a little bit that was left over, we hired a consultant to study interoperability of what we call P25 trunked systems. These are going to be digital systems, and P25 refers to an open or an interoperable standard, not a proprietary and a closed standard. And forgive me, because I live in this world, I may use acronyms a little more. Please interrupt at any time and ask if I find myself slipping down that rat hole, which I hope not to.
Before you go on, let me interject. Some of the members may wonder why we have this in this committee. And there are two answers. One is that I've been involved in interoperability since I was first elected in the House. It's been one of the things I've worked on a lot. The other reason is that this committee, when I asked for it from the Senate president, I was assured that all IT projects would come through this committee, and this is an IT project. It doesn't sound like it, but it is. So I just wanted to make that clear why it's here. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there are IT components to all these systems now that they're digital systems, servers, switches, routers, all those other things that, especially at the public safety level, built to what we call public safety grade, not commercial grade, are also very expensive, but they need to be very reliable. The two are in parallel. So moving back a little bit, so we hired, with some of that surplus funding, we hired a consultant to study these primary P25 digital trunked systems in Oregon and what it would take for them to become interoperable. And so the technology is out there. It really comes down to not just cost, but operational requirements about why it takes so much time to make these systems interoperable. So in a nutshell, you can see on the slide on the screen what we studied at the time, 14 systems. The two large red dots are systems in the state of Washington that interoperate with our public safety agencies, and we interoperate with them. So, again, in the world of acronyms, CRESA is basically the Clark County, Washington system. Yeah, I can't see it too well, but BCES is the red circle on the right in southeastern Washington. That's Benton County, Washington, which is basically the Tri-Cities area. And then you get into the Oregon-based systems. Starting in the west, you have TriMet and City of Portland. WACA, which is, generally speaking, Washington County, and they're tied to Clackamas County, which you see there is called C-800, the City of Salem, and LBRIG is the Lynn-Benton system. Below that is the Lane County or LRIG system, and IWIN is actually a federal system. And then we have our own ODOT-OSP radio system, which is what this project was designed to study. And you see it next to it, DC-911. That's Deschutes County, and that the agreements have been finished, and they're already, I don't want to say absorbed, because that is absolutely not the right word, maybe a subscriber, and they use that system. So we don't have call-out separately for them, which you'll see in a few minutes. FDN. Oh. Senator
Brzezinski.
Question. The ones that are on this display are the ones that were looked at. There are other ones in the state besides this. I'm assuming something in Southern Oregon or Cape Falls. Is there not?
Yeah, Senator, members of the committee, again, this project studied 14
right.
of what we call P25 trunked systems. And so these are the majority of those systems. There are several other non-P25, non-trunked systems using other frequencies. And I wasn't prepared to get very technical here today.
No, that's fine.
But, yes, in addition to those 500 primary and 300 secondary first responders, using the lowest common denominator of what is a radio system, which is a base station and a mobile, based on the FCC licensing, we estimate we have around 430 of those. So we have a lift ahead of us trying to continue always to make all radio systems interoperable.
Right.
But these are the larger, again, P25, which is that open standard digital systems.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this our 911 systems?
I beg your pardon?
Is this their 9/11 systems?
No. Senator, members of the committee, these are not the 911 centers, though they may be subscribers or users of the system. Certainly our first responders work through them, but this is not what we call PSAP, Public Safety Answering Point systems.
So it doesn't include those. This is something different.
That's correct.
Great. Thank you.
So to finish the itemization, FDN is a, I believe it's an IGA of Wheeler, Gilliam, and Sherman counties that provides some network connectivity in that area. And UMRAD is the Umatilla-Morrow Radio and Data District. So those are the systems that we studied. And we did that mostly calendar last year and into the early spring. And we presented the results of that study to the Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness back in May. And we had some aggregate findings there. And in general, it was that at a capital level, it would take around $7 million to finish bringing those systems to be at the highest level of interoperability with one another, and that's this P25 standard you hear me talking about. And they use these open standard interfaces. And at the after that, we were asked to identify with some specificity by radio system what that might look like. And I need to do a fairly large caveat here, in that we really won't know unless there was both funding for it and then, of course, an RFP followed. And until you get results of the RFP, you're not really sure what all these costs are going to be. But based on our experience and the request to come up with some idea, we have pulled these figures together. And so without ado, let me just go to the next slide. And I'm sorry for the small type, but I wanted to put it all on one page. And you'll see that Deschutes, for example, doesn't exist on here because it's already been, some of those agreements have already happened and they're already working with the ODOT-OSP system. These figures are really, again, that ODOT-OSP radio system is one of those 400 radio systems in Oregon. It's not the only one. For purposes of our study, we used that as what it would take for everybody who's P25, these other systems, to interoperate with that as the base system through which the other systems go through. Why? Because ours is a statewide system. We're not regionally or localized. And so it made some sense from a study perspective to approach it in that fashion. So without really going into too much detail, and I thought I'd err on the side of giving you more detail than perhaps you wanted, we've really just sort of lined up the primary cost elements and then lined them out. And you have to have investment by both radio systems. So in this case, we would need investment by the state. But without the corollary of investment by one of these other radio systems, we wouldn't have interoperability. So it all needs to be very highly coordinated. And right now, it somewhat is. As you know, the state radio project finished last year. They're incorporating all those changes still. We do not have a plan to go forward, say, with itemized with each of these systems for interoperability. We're somewhat opportunistic at this point. For example, we know the city of Salem is buying an ISSI, as we call it, this open standards gateway, and we're buying one. And so we know that as we both implement them, we will be able to set up our system. So, for example, state police will be actually able to roam onto that network as they go up eastward on Highway 20. So that's a level of interoperability that we're pretty excited about going forward, but it does take a lot of time. These are complex systems with complex technologies, and there are 14 is enough, and it requires a very sophisticated high degree of cooperation from both sides to plan and instigate and implement the interoperability with these interfaces. So the primary elements are going to be the capital cost, which is often hardware, software, and licensing. And then you'll see some staff time or some consultant time to people to program and set these all up. And that has to happen on what we call the A side and the B side, in this case the state side, and then these other 13 systems side. And then the cost is built off to the right and to the bottom. You can see the total cost for both sides. The state's cost for these systems remaining is just shy of $1.5 million. And again, very rough estimates. Want to put all the caveats I can on those numbers. And then you can see that for the other systems, it would be around $4.4 million. And part of this, again, is because we not only have all these different frequencies on radio systems, but there are multiple vendors that we have to have, and their systems are interoperating. There's Tate, and there's Motorola, of course, and the state system is a Harris system, and there's E.F. Johnson and some others. And so all that has to be factored into. And then on the towards the right, you will see estimated number of agencies. This was kind of a swag at the number of agencies under the umbrella of where these systems are physically located. And then what we do is we manage, we put the users into what we call talk groups. So it'll be a command talk group and all these various talk groups. And so those are the numbers that you'll see on the right. And you can see that as we move into interoperability and this on these digital platforms, it allows us a lot more flexibility with a lot more agencies and talk groups. And before I go any further, are there any questions?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What about Washington, Idaho, Nevada, and California? Are we trying to standardize with other states?
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, yes, that's a great question, and we certainly are. And we did inventory, if you will, or talk to them before our consultant did, as we initiated the original study, to see if they had these P25 trunked digital systems on their borders, and they did not. So we are doing interoperability with them, but it's more, if you will, conventional interoperability. So this, again, is the P25 trunked systems.
So you just said something, conventional interoperability. What is that?
Well, I also looked at the sky, Senator, when I said that. in a sense, there are digital and not digital or analog systems. And The largest number of radio systems are these analog, and they're in the UHF and VHF frequencies. There are some in the HF frequencies. Mm-hmm. When you get into digital, typically it's a digital analog, if you will, is where I was trying to go with that. And because the digital technologies are, they have so much more capability, but they are also much more expensive. That is the dilemma that we have, especially as our population grows and our public safety needs and footprint grows. We have these larger systems, and they're pushing out and becoming interoperable or needing to have interoperability with the less expensive analog systems on UHF or VHF rather than 700 or 800, but I'm getting more technical than I wanted to already. But it's a technical distinction.
So one of the differences going to digital is digital doesn't fall off. In analog systems, if you go farther distance, your ability to understand what's being said drops off. With digital systems, it's either very understandable or it's not there. And that's one of the good reasons to go to digital, among others. But that's a very good reason to be going to digital.
Thank you. So, other questions?
I do have a question.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski. Yeah.
So, David, I guess what I'm going to ask is, it must be at least 10 years, if not 15 years ago, in Lane County, we were looking at this issue about how you had the agencies not able to communicate with each other, and, of course, how did you get there? Mm-hmm. So back then, I would assume there was much more reliant on analogical versus digital. Now we've got this exponential shift happening to digital. Can you tell me whether or not, or where we're at in the sense of some just generality of people upgrading, knowing that they need to be really focusing on the future and not just trying to buy maybe the cheapest system so they can, in fact, communicate with each other?
Senator, members of the committee, I wish I really could with, again, 800 public safety entities, right, primary and secondary, and 400 and some radio systems. That's something we're struggling to get our hands around on a different front and seeing if we can fund a full environmental scan and inventory and getting it into a database so that everybody has access to it, and we will know that on a much better detail. At a very high level, I think it's appropriate. Everyone understands the criticality of public safety communications. We get after incident, we get these after action reports, and the agencies will typically do them after any kind of a major report. And time and time and time again, the issue of communications comes up over and over. And that was also the case in the Cascadia exercise, and the after action report there is interoperability, as well as operability when you have that level of a cataclysmic event happen. But interoperability is, we know it's an issue. We know how to address it. It's wide and deep. And again, as you pointed out, expensive. And so these things need to take time as they develop. And that's one of the conflicts we get, for example, in Lane County, as you mentioned, is you might have a more well-funded radio system, say, in a city with, I'm just going to pick this out because I don't know it for sure, say City of Eugene and its member agencies. But as they serve, and we have these mutual aid agreements, and they starting to serve these other communities that, say, have an analog system, then how do they interoperate? And that smaller, maybe more rural agency might not be able to afford the digital handsets at $8,000 a piece and so forth, and they need to stay with their existing system. And then it's up to us to all figure out how we can work with them, and that we can all increase or retain what interoperability we have and improve it where we can within the financial and operational constraints of any given system. So that said, I just want to finish with that. Another piece of what I do in my role is I staff the Statewide Interoperability Executive Committee, and that's created by statute. And it is a committee that's roughly made up of 11 state agency heads and about 11 local public safety agency heads, Sheriff's Association, Police Association, Fire Association, and so forth, AOC, LOC, and then for the state agencies of ODOT, Military Department, Emergency Management, Forestry, and, you know, several others. It's in ORS 403, 445, and about where that authority comes from in this committee. And it meets quarterly. And we've had this organized since just after 9/11. And we work together. There was a technical committee and a strategic planning committee and an executive committee and a partnership committee. And we work together to address these issues on a very cooperative basis. The statute's set up that it's a kind of a festival of the willing, if you will. We don't have hammer authority, nor do we really want it. Everybody who's a public safety and first responder knows we need interoperability. It's how do we get there, and how do we get there most wisely. And that committee meets quarterly, like I said, and has for, 16 years now to address these issues.
And the legislature has two seats, a Senate seat and a House seat. I was the House member when I was in the House. I believe Senator Johnson is the Senate member now.
Senator, that is correct. And Representative Lively from the House side is the other member.
Any questions at this point?
Yes.
Yes, Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what are we being asked to do? Is this like $4 million for funding?
We're not, at this point, being asked to do anything. A request, if there is one, will come through a different committee, probably. If there is a POP that's requested, of course, it'll go through Ways and Means, but probably be reviewed by the Joint IT Committee. And possibly by the committee that he presented to before, Senator Boquist's
Emergency
Preparedness Committee. But this committee will also be asked to review the POP, possibly. But there is no POP yet. There may or may not be one, but I wanted to bring the committee up to speed on what's the possibility, because I want to pursue it. I want to make sure that we don't forget about what we started 17 years ago, and we've had some fits and starts, if you will. Owen, know about Owen, and it had its problems, and it got turned over to ODOT to do a portion of what Owen was going to do, and that was the state police portion, and that's done. And I want to make sure we don't drop the notion of eventually getting it as interoperable as we possibly can, because it's really important when you have a real emergency and you have multiple agencies converging on an emergency that they be able to talk to each other. And currently that's not the case necessarily. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. Sometimes they actually trade radios. And this is a situation that we want to get away from as much as possible. Tell me if I've said something wrong.
Senator, members of the committee, no, that sounds about right. And there's a continuum of what they call interoperability, and you mentioned trading radios, and that's kind of the lowest, which is our radio systems don't talk to one another. Here, you take one of my radios as a spare and put it on the front seat, and I'll do the same. And that happens more often than you would know. And it's good that we can do that, but we're trying to get to the other end of the interoperability spectrum with this full open standard digital system, so our system of systems kind of operates like one. As I mentioned, the OSP, for example, on the Salem radio system, after all the SIs are built out and all the agreements are signed.
The halfway in between is basically I can talk to someone on my radio, but I have to change bands. So switching back and forth between bands on a radio to talk to different people. And that's more acceptable than trading radios, but it's still not where we want to be. So,
just to follow up, so is the military included in this, National Guard and Air Guard?
Let me go back to the other.
I can't read that.
At the bottom there, you'll see IWN, and that's the federal system. And it's my understanding that because the National Guard is at least in part federally funded, that they use the federal network. Oregon Emergency Management, for example, which is under the military department, does. You know, they've got the Anderson Readiness Center, and they can do the interoperability and so forth. And they probably, well, I don't want to even speak for their relationship to the National Guard, but the answer is I believe the National Guard falls under the federal system and uses federal frequencies and gear.
So why wouldn't we use the federal system and gear? I mean, it seems like you should have all your states together, the National Guard together, so in a true emergency, we're all hooked up, right?
That'd be wonderful.
Seems pretty basic.
Well, they use different senator members of the committee. It's my understanding, and I haven't sat down with the people that run the federal network to find out, but it's my understanding that the federal system uses different block of frequencies that are dedicated to federal use, and the DOD has its own frequencies within that, and that it's not for our use. There are some states where the federal agencies are subscribers or use parts of state systems, but it typically doesn't go the other way.
So, and as you know, Al, know, having state systems and federal systems is pretty pervasive in every area. So, this is one of them.
Well, that's our goal, to fix all that, right?
It'd be nice, but we can't do it, unfortunately. The federal system would have to start to agree that we could use their bands, and they're not there.
And ham radio operators fit somewhere into this as the very, very basic backup.
Actually, go ahead.
Senator, members of the committee, yes, ham radio is an important piece of our overall emergency preparedness and response equation. Typically, the ham radio or the amateur radio in Oregon is coordinated through emergency management. And as we've seen with the disasters and the hurricanes in Texas and Florida, they're very important to the response. But again, they use different frequencies and, again, different radios and different gear. So they're a piece of the puzzle, but not of this interoperable puzzle.
They're a backup plan.
They've been very, senators, they've been very critical in some of our response, most notably the Vernonia floods. The story I'm reminded of repeatedly is that nothing worked during the Vernonia floods, which was 6, 8, 10 years ago. But the ham radio did, and that's how the emergency communications were established.
And part of the reason nothing worked was because the towers weren't firm enough, and alignment got out. So this was a problem. But anything else? Thank you very much. I appreciate you bringing us up to date of where we would like to go and possibly how we could get there. So,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the opportunity and appreciate the chance to always promote public safety communications and our first responders, and thank you for that support.
Don't adjourn us yet.
I wasn't going to. I was just going to.
So you're quick sometimes.
No, I'm going. Yes, I'm going to. I'm going to end this informational session. And what do we have for the any other comments or questions for the rest of the? Thank you very much for your presentation,
David. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I just was going over. I knew we dealt with the issue on the emails. I know we went back and forth. Right. I said, well, we passed that, I thought. So
we did.
So I'm looking at what we did, and I'm assuming what we may potentially be looking at is the distribution to candidates and or office holders of the emails. Because, I mean, that's the only thing I'm looking as to that was the only exception to non-disclosure.
Yeah, that's...
I just want to make sure I'm on the page as to... Because at this point, you know, my office is, I guess, taking the position they're not publishable.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception that's put in there.
Right. Okay. And so you were the one who brought this up. What is it that you think that we should do from there?
Well, it seems to me like on the Senate floor we had some misunderstandings of what the bill actually did, and it should prohibit any distribution of email addresses where it has a couple exclusions in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't gone back and looked at it, but I know there was concern, and the bill didn't do what we thought it would do.
Yeah. And if I remember right, it was at our discretion, each individual's discretion, about even those two exemptions. Is that correct?
What it says is the subsection, this is the exception, this is for reference under number 40A, actually 40C, is where it talks about A, it includes the legislative department, and then it says under 40C, this subsection and RS 244.040 do not prohibit the campaign office of the current office holder or current candidates who have filed to run for that elective office from receiving, upon request, the electronic mail addresses used by the current office holders, legislative office for newsletters distributions, except that the campaign office that receives the electronic mail addresses under this paragraph may not re-disclose, in other words, pass it along to someone else. So I don't see a shall or I mean, it seems to me like I don't think we can prohibit them based on the way this
is. I agree, and I think the intent was that it would be at your discretion whether you gave them to that next person who was running for the office, and that's not how it turned out. It turned out it sounds like you have to give it to them if they ask, and I think that is not what we intended.
It's very confusing, needless to say.
Okay. So we were asked for ours, and
we had a very specific request come in.
We had a very specific
request come in. Dates.
Hmm?
That, and I don't know how that ended up, various offices. I mean, it was a blanket request.
Yeah.
But I know there was confusion.
Well, LC, I mean, Legislative Council is actually handling that particular situation if it's the one I'm thinking
right.
about.
It generated off that bill is what was causing it, I believe, because it was very date specific, especially in the request that after a certain day they couldn't, before a certain day they could. The basic line is that anybody that gives us an email should expect and get some confidentiality on their email address.
Yeah. So what you'd like to do is take the exemption out.
I think so. I'd like to make it so it read more in real English about what you couldn't do.
Okay.
As long as you read that over and over and over, it gets more confusing.
I don't know. I mean, we had this discussion and we talked about right. whether or not we as individual office holders should have access and utilizing email addresses that came to our office for legislative purposes in a campaign setting. And then I thought the discussions went, well, if you did that, that's going to look kind of, getting the current office holder an advantage. And I thought the discussion was to counter that, was to allow for those who actually had filed for running for that office to be able to receive the same information that the current office holder was accessing and using. It seems to me that either if you want it to be prohibited, you just take out the sub C, and it just basically says even us as office holders would not be able to utilize for campaign purposes, is the way I would interpret that. I don't know prove that something came from one place versus getting it some other way, unless you just did a drop where you just loaded all of the emails that came into your office into
the campaign.
Into the campaign, whatever mechanism, either on a thumb drive or whatever.
So quit using the mail.gov, and that should take care of it. But
yeah.
Okay. Well, was the concern, maybe just part of clarifying the concern here, I think there was a date by which certain entities knew that after that time they would not be able to
make the request.
So then, is that the concern? I mean, I think that day has passed now, so, or was it beyond that?
That was what the one we got was.
Just reading what we passed is, it's very confusing.
Yeah, I didn't see.
Maybe it doesn't need to be changed, and maybe the date afterwards was okay, but.
I didn't see anything about dates in here as to what we actually was enrolled. The only bold print, new print, was this addition to include us into the exemption from disclosure with the exception to that. And then what we had was a discussion as to whether we wanted this to go into effect immediately, and we said no. And we said on the 91st day that would allow anyone to challenge it if they wanted to challenge it.
And that's where the date came in, I think.
That might be it.
Yeah, somebody was calculating when the 91st day would be and said, hey, by this date we need to make this request.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, for someone that's right.
Right. Now I see where that plays in now.
So that's done. The only people now who can make that request are people who have filed for your office.
On either party.
Yeah.
Or any party.
Any party, not either.
That's correct.
There are multiple parties.
Which means people can ask for the email address if they just file. And they're barred in this from sending it on to somebody else.
Correct.
Right.
So they can use it only for campaign purposes. Or if elected, they can use it for office.
For their
office.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's how I read it.
Go ahead. I'm just wondering if somebody does decide to send it on to a third party, I don't think there's any teeth in it.
Oh, no.
How many
laws do we pass that have no teeth?
A lot.
Yeah. So,
I mean, this doesn't have it, but there could be somewhere else in the statutes already that says any illegal disclosures.
Sure.
Have whatever the sanctions are. It just isn't in this bill. That doesn't mean we don't have them somewhere.
Right.
You would hope.
In the public records law, there are some teeth, and the Attorney General uses them occasionally. So
it would be interesting to investigate what. Okay, so if this happens, then what? And maybe that needs to be tightened up.
So in the 19 session, we're going to be looking more into public records, and one of the committee bills that I'm hoping to do in the 19 session is to gather all the public records exemptions into one spot in the ORS, so that they're clear and all together, so that we can actually find them. The Attorney General is helping me do this, so it's already in the works. That they've already started to gather everything and and make a database. So that's one of the things that we want to look at in 19. But we just don't have enough bills to do everything we want to do. But that's one of the things
more
I want
time.
For 19.
Thank goodness.
So anything else for the good of the order? We're adjourned.
Adjourned.
Order.